Welcome to Nectar's Conversation Journeys. We travel to or invite the movers and shakers of the mobility, energy, and climate ecosystem. Listen in and enjoy the talks.
I'm excited today to welcome a guest from across the pond, Bernhard Wagner, a climate economist at Columbia Business School. And I'm specifically excited as we had a webinar session on sustainability in the bigger context a while ago. And today you have the opportunity to talk to Bernhard directly and learn more about his thoughts and how they relate to what we're doing. Welcome, Bernhard.
Great to be here.
Hi. So thanks. And first of all, obligatory question. If you just present yourself, talk a little bit about yourself and what you're doing at the Columbia Business School.
Sure. Climate economist. Have never really done anything else, I can tell you, which, you know, in, let's say, 1998 or 2002 or something was a bit of an oxymoron. You know, by now, I don't think anyone would consider it to be an oxymoron anymore. It's still a little bit odd in the sense of, wait, are we talking about climate versus the economy or climate and economy, right? The opportunities, talking about risks or opportunities. And okay, what do I do here at the business school? It's a bit of both, right? Of course, it's about climate risk. And yes, I teach a class called Climate Risk. Of course, it's also about opportunities, transformation, and so on. And yes, frankly, most of what I do is focus on, okay, what are the technologies? What are the investable, scalable technologies and pathways to, in fact, decarbonize the world, if you will, but maybe specifically some of the sectors that we don't typically put front and center, right? Steel, cement, where it seems to be a lot harder on the one hand. On the other hand, there are some pretty clear pathways as well. And yeah, the big question is how to do it, how to get there.
Well, thank you very much for the let's say first overview. I have the pleasure to talk to someone who's monitored what the ecosystem for more than two decades, right? And that's something very special. So from a macro view, have you seen, let's say, any kind of cycles, hype cycles happening? I remember 2010, 12, there was like this big climate tech wave, right? And then it got very, very quiet. And now 2-3 years ago is another one, I felt. Yep. But I guess you have a much, much broader view on those happenings on the macro scale. Can you describe a little bit what you saw there over the course of 25 years? And where do you think that we are in right now?
I mean, yeah, depends on your politics, if you will, but also depends on, I guess, the horizon, right? As in, if you look, right, if the focus is 6 months out, right? Quite literally, right? If the focus is, okay, what do I do today to make money tomorrow? Then yeah, we are on climate tech terms in a bit of a trough, right?
Yeah.
Clearly. Right. So, you know, literally last night, the US Senate passed a bill that is going to subsidize coal production in the US to the tune of $1 billion. Right. So if right about now you own stocks in, you know, Peabody Coal, you made quite a bit of money last night. Mm. Right. So yeah, right. Fair to say, of course, right? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. You know, if that's your horizon, right? Then, you know, climate is out and, you know, fossil energy is in. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Obviously, right? The way I described it just now, I don't think that's the right time horizon. I don't think that's the right view of the world. So in some sense, all you need to do is look a few years out, if you will. Look at the climate policy pendulum swinging back and forth to realize that at the end of the day, of course, it is only a question of if, not when. Sorry, the other way around. It's only a question of when, not if, we decide that. It sounded wrong when I said it. It's only a question of when, not if, you know, climate technologies, which are in fact technologies, right, that can only get better and cheaper over time, whereas coal, oil, gas are commodities that will always fluctuate, right? So, you know, none of this is a secret, right? Quite literally, right? So, and maybe not 20 years, 25 years, but let's go back 200 years. The price of coal for the past 200 years has basically been approximately constant, right? There are fluctuations, sure. But the cost of producing electricity from coal has not changed, adjusted for inflation, for 200 years.
Wow, I had no clue about this. This is really interesting.
And then you look at solar PV, which, okay, solar PV is sort of the extreme example, if you will. But, you know, 40 years ago, 45 years ago by now, when Jimmy Carter put, you know, the half dozen solar panels on the White House roof, solar PV was 100 times more expensive than today. 50 years ago, when, you know, Angela Merkel started subsidizing the Energiewende, energy transition in Germany, started subsidizing solar panels were 10 times more, 12 times more than they are today, right? So back then, yeah, we needed subsidies to push solar PV into the system. Like, we could already see, you know, Merkel saw that it's going to get cheaper. And okay, we've got to help climb the learning curve, slide down the cost curve. How do we do that? By spending some taxpayer money on the subsidies to help jumpstart this process. Okay, fast forward to today. Germans are installing solar panels as garden fences, right? I mean, you know, we've sort of seen these examples, right? You know, like, and now, okay, why, right? This is not the best way to put a solar panel, right? Like, why would you put it vertically if you can, like, adjust it? Well, okay, you know why? Because that stuff is almost as cheap as wood. I mean, it's not quite as cheap as wood, right? Turns out, but it's almost cheap. It keeps the dog in and the car charged. So why not, right? Like, it's sort of, and it's the sort of thing where, you know, again, right? Is that the best example? No, because it's not the best place to put the solar panels. And by the way, it's not the sort of thing we should be talking about when we say solar PV, because there are much greater, better opportunities than, you know, retrofitting the single family home in the burbs, right? Like, yeah, problems with that too, right? But on the other hand, it shows how technologically, right, climate tech, solar PV, battery prices decreased by 50% in the last 18 months. Literally. So like 18 months ago, it was, okay, battery pretty cheap. Solar plus battery, yeah, almost as cheap as the fossil alternative. And, you know, Putin blows a fuse. And once again, right, solar PV is absolutely in the money. But, you know, at the end of the day, the trends were clear. Nobody predicted that prices would collapse by another 50% within a year and a half.
Got it. So do I hear correctly that with sustainable energy sources, for example, right, the price curve is down and economies of scale fit in and technological advancements, et cetera, right? And that's still happening, which at a certain point in time, this is just beat fossil fuel based energy just by cost. Is that what I hear?
Of course. And to be clear, solar PV already does that. And let me just show, sort of point to one example, Texas, right? So, okay. So nobody would mistake Texas as sort of the US state that has, you know, climate policy front. It doesn't, right? It just, okay. Now, it is true that Texas can now take the advantage of the same federal policies that other states can, right? So California and Texas get the same federal subsidies, right? Okay. Thanks to another Austro-American you may have heard of, California came first, right? So Schwarzenegger signed a bunch of laws into place as governor, you know, California took off first with solar PV. And, you know, that happened sometime sort of 2012 or so. You saw a real pickup in utility scale solar capacity in California. And that pickup has been steady and been going up ever since. Texas surpassed California in total utility scale solar PV installation in October or so of last year.
Okay.
And the takeoff was rapid, right? Like Texas started in like 2016, 2017, and takeoff was rapid. And this was not because of state level policies, right? It was because...
It's what I wanted to say, right? This is not policy driven, right? This is financially driven.
So if you were in it to make a buck, like quite literally, if you were in it to make a buck, you will look to solar PV as the cheapest source of electricity that can make you the biggest profit based on your investment, right? Raw economic terms. And actually, it's so radical. I mean, the price cuts have been so radical, and the profitability of solar PV points in one and only one direction, that actually Texas by now, the state legislature in Texas was proposing laws to basically make it more difficult for solar PV and wind and batteries to come onto the grid in order to preserve the profits of the fossil fuel industry, right? And we, by the way, we see this at the federal level. Like, the most radical of those proposals were in fact killed, but like, there was a proposal for a new tax as part of this Senate bill, HR1, the very first budget bill that the Trump administration was trying to push through, is pushing through. There was even a tax introduced between 30 and 50% on solar PV and wind, and only on solar PV and wind. Why? Because fossil fuels are now losing in the US compared to solar. Now, okay, yes, there's still tax credits for solar PV, and those tax credits are in fact important to keep the momentum going, A, and B, right? So there are still hurdles to overcome that are not as simple as saying, oh, wave ahead, right? Solar PV, utility scale solar, is not physically the same as the gas plant, right? It takes more land. It needs to be built where there wasn't fossil fuel infrastructure before, for the most part. So you need to connect those panels to the grid, right? So if you basically, you keep building more coal plants, and by the way, nobody's building coal plants these days, but if you build a gas plant at the same position where there used to be a coal plant, connecting that to the grid is easy because the lines are already there. There's no interconnection queue, to use the technical term. For solar PV, not that easy. And then you actually, when you look at the interconnection queue in the US, as in that proposed projects looking to be connected to the grid, that queue to 90% or so, 95% is solar PV and batteries. Or put differently, nobody's building anything else, right? Mm-hmm. In the US right now, we're still only building solar on the one hand and batteries on the other. And the fascinating thing, of course, is that, okay, again, solar can only get better and cheaper, whereas coal, gas, oil will only fluctuate. So whether that's electricity consumption production on the one hand, or let's say electrification of transport, right? Very much the same idea, where basically at the end of the day, of course, electric vehicles are only going to get better and cheaper. Whereas, okay, internal combustion engines, right? We've been at it for about 100 plus years, right?
Yes.
Yeah, you can tease out the 5% efficiency, but that's about it, right? Yes, I'm on team climate tech.
Thank you. Thank you for the very thorough explanation. I got a question on this one, because if the numbers are so clear, right, and the data supporting are so clear, why, brackets the heck, brackets, are we in Europe, where there is a political agenda supporting that direction, so slow in execution, getting things done? Do you have an interpretation of the why?
Do you want the political version, or do you want the slightly less cynical version? So let me start with the politics.
Go for it.
Take a look at the list of the most profitable companies on the planet. Saudi Aramco made, what, $35 billion in raw profit last quarter, 3 months, right? Now, okay, not a European company, turns out, but okay, within Europe, right? Who is profitable? Well, profitability, of course, narrowly defined, by the way, right? Okay, if you are able to basically take fossil fuels out of the ground more or less for free, because, you up the land leased to you for, cheaply, and then you sell the stuff and nobody has to pay for the consequences of the burning of those fossil fuels, by and large, which of course, fortunately, is no longer the case, but still, you're wildly profitable from the status quo, right? So, okay, this is the prior German government, right? But, you know, the Wärmepumpengesetz, right? The heat pump, right? That sort of, the sort of law that more or less caused the government to, in fact, fall apart, right? So that was literally, okay, why did push come to shove on this? Because there is a lot of money to be made from the status quo. And yeah, you know, heat pumps are a fundamentally better technology. And once again, I would very much say that they are a better way to heat your home. They're a better way to heat and cool your home, by the way, right? You don't just, you know, you get two in one. The raw physics says that they're much more efficient, right? You know, that your gas furnace is the best gas furnace you can get is like 95% efficient. A heat pump without even trying, an air heat pump, not a geothermal one, an air heat pump is like 300-400% efficient.
Wow.
Right? Like you get four times as much energy out and you put electricity in. Why? Because it takes energy. I mean, we're not violating laws of physics here. We are taking the energy from ambient air, right? But right. So just the raw physics points in only one direction. Okay. Now, how do the economics align? Well, it turns out increasingly you don't actually need any subsidies, but yes, one does still, right? And by the way, the financing challenge for the heat pump is more than for the gas furnace. Why? Because for heat pump, it's all in the upfront cost, much like the solar panels or the batteries, right? Once it's installed, it's cheap to operate, right? You're printing money, but you need to be able to finance the money, right? So, okay, you and I might have the $10,000 sitting in the bank account to be able to make the investment, but okay, you have the average household with the gas furnace that basically, you know, by the way, that crashed exactly when you need it the most, right? So it turns out your gas furnace doesn't die in August. It dies on December 24th in the afternoon when it's like cold outside. You really need it. And yeah, the contractor shows up, hopefully that evening, right? That afternoon, and says, you know what? I can make your Christmas Eve pleasant. I have the gas furnace sitting in my truck outside, and it costs, you know, it's like $1,200. It's $1,500. It's cheap. Swap in and out, 2 hours, $1,500, and you have it warm again tonight. Or for $15,000 and 6 weeks, I can install the perfect heat pump for you by the end of next month.
Yes.
You're going to do, right? Guess what? Now, never mind. Economics increasingly work in favor of heat pumps already, but okay, it takes a bit of advanced planning. Yes, it takes some subsidies, it takes some modifications to your home. And frankly, it takes having the $15,000 sit in your checking account in order to be able to put up the money, right?
Yes. I never thought of gas furnaces as being like a subscription type of business model, but it is.
Paying the subscription, you know, you're sending your
the gas, right?
Money to the Kremlin. Yeah. But yeah,
exactly. 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 It's like an espresso, a little bit like an espresso model.
See, I love that, right? Nothing wrong with George Clooney. So Nespresso,
absolutely. Should,
right? On the other hand, yeah, you could see how investing in your own espresso machine, right? Up front. Okay, A, makes for better coffee, and B, is in fact the better way to live, right? Also economically, but you need the money up front to pay, right, much more, as opposed to the analogy I would have is the printers, right? The HP printer, which are literally now free. I mean, you can, like, actually, I never realized this. I haven't had a printer in a while, and I looked into getting one again. Turns out, not quite. But for under $100, you get a decent printer, but the ink cartridge costs at least as much, right? Every six, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Speaking of coffee, cheers.
Cheers. No, very interesting. Very interesting thought there. What role, let's stay on the macro level. I learned through reading Hans Rosling and his Factfulness book, that the continent to watch in the next, let's say, 30, 50 years, because that's where development is going to happen, is going to be Asia.
Yes.
So what developments do you see there that, like, from old Europe perspective, we might not be aware, but that might really have an impact on global scale.
Okay, so there's a lot here, of course, right? So I think the macro conclusion in some sense is that I think it is absolutely right that the world is going from petrostate to electrostate. And there's a lot in these terms, right? So petrostate doesn't just mean oil. It also means autocracy.
Yeah.
Right? Like those are linked. Okay.
Yes.
Much like electrostate in some sense doesn't just mean, oh, lovely electrification and everything is going to work out. It also means, hey, China is an electrostate. You know, we don't call Iceland an electrostate, although Iceland does not burn fossil fuels for electricity. It's not an electrostate. You know, that's a tiny, lovely little democracy up there floating around in the North Sea. North of the North Sea turns out, but never mind, in the Atlantic. So there's a flavor to this that actually we shouldn't 100% embrace, right, as the answer. So in other words, I think it is fair to say that a country like China has what you might call an easier time pursuing this full-on electrification pathway than, let's say, you know, Germany, France, Austria, European countries. Okay, why? Well, two reasons. One, lots of the infrastructure is in many ways growing into a void, right? You're not replacing old, you're just building new. That's all it's easier. Yeah. And it's easier for two reasons, right? One is physically, as in there's, you know, you don't have the old building sitting here that needs to be electrified. You're just building a new building that's better and cheaper to build from scratch anyways, right? So there's that. The second, of course, is there is no vested interest trying to defend the status quo, right? You are in fact growing into a void. You're making money going into the void, as opposed to basically saying, oh, there's the profitable company over there that needs to go away in order for the new technology to come up, right? Huge difference. Now, okay, Europe, right? So yeah, what do we do, right? Well, interesting example is Germany in this for a couple of reasons. But so Germany, yes, has been in a recession for 2 years now, right? And, you know, going into third year. And actually, back to energy, Chris Wright, the U.S. Energy Secretary, his very first speech, literally the first time he came out as the new energy secretary and gave a speech, he spent a third of his time on Germany. Now he's the U.S. energy secretary and he's talking about Germany. Like, okay, dude, like, you know which country you are in, right? So, okay. Well, turns out he was going through, you know, the implications of the Energiewende and sort of talking about, you know, what Germany got wrong. And okay, newsflash, turns out Chris Wright did not get everything right when he talked about Germany. There's an agreement, right? What he did get right was he talked about how energy prices in Germany today are 2 to 3 times higher than they were 15 years ago, right? And you can see where this is going for all the obvious reasons, right? So, okay, yes. One of the reasons why Germany is in a recession is because of high energy prices, of course. And by the way, they're not just homegrown, right? This is Putin blowing a fuse. February 24th, 22, right? And by February 27th, gas prices 10x, right? So there's a lot going on here, of course. Mm-hmm. And that connects to climate change, just to be clear, right? It's dependent on cheap Russian gas. But still, there are lots of factors. One factor, a very real factor, is that Germany has been trying to transform its energy system for 15 plus years. And yeah, I would argue that it has not gotten the balance right of who pays for the transformation. And to put it bluntly, there are three sources of money in the world, literally. There are three sources of money, right? There are shareholders, ratepayers, to talk about electricity, and taxpayers, right? Like, there's nobody else here, right? Like, you either own the company and you basically make a profit, right? Shareholders, you pay for the output. Or taxpayers, right? We all tax ourselves and then we decide, hopefully democratically, who gets the subsidies, the money, and what are our priorities as a society, right?
Got it.
Turns out, by the way, and then there are shareholders, of course, who work for utilities and who work for steel companies, let's say, or who own utilities or steel companies. And there are also consumers or ratepayers, right? Who pay for the electricity on the one hand, or who, let's say, pay for the steel on the other, right? And of course, there are fundamental differences. But back to shareholders, ratepayers, taxpayers, utility shareholders are doing pretty well in Germany.
Yes.
In Europe, right?
All over Europe.
Yeah. Right?
Yes.
Ratepayers? Not so much, right? Paying three times as much in Germany now than 15 years ago. So households pay for the bill in order to make the investments in this transformation. And yeah, there's some taxpayer money. There were some subsidies, especially early on.
Top of it.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, right. Okay. And again, not to make this all about the politics, but you know, sorry, we've been doing this for, you know, forever, right? So, you know, Karl Marx versus, you know, Adam Smith or whatever, right? Like we know the old, you know, dusty books that sort of say the same thing, that basically say, look, you've got to get the balance right here. And it's really hard. I mean, I'm very glad I'm not in politics, especially not German politics, right? Or Austrian for that matter. But so it's easier as an academic to sit back and say, oh, look, there are three sources of money in the world. No. Okay. This transformation, it's not if it's when, it's about who pays, of course, right? And politics is about, let's get the balance right between, you know, in Austrian dimensions, let's say, between the EVN, the Lower Austrian Energy Company, that is making a killing because of high electricity prices.
Mm.
When Putin invades Ukraine, utility companies celebrate. Their profits go up dramatically, right? Okay, well, okay, if they celebrate and let's say there are some politicians who benefit from that, how are policies going to look? Right? How are we going to transform? So the difficulty in Europe to transform its economy relative to Asia, let's say China especially, but you know, lots of other countries too, has something to do with the structure, the embedded technical, physical structure on the one hand, and of course the politics, right? Because some of the most profitable companies on the planet benefit from the status quo. And by the way, right, let's say you are the Chancellor of Austria. You don't have the cell phone number of the, you know, the sexy new startup that's going to make a lot of money in the new future. But damn right, you know, the address on the Pöstlingberg, or the head of First Alpine has his mansion, right? You've been there. Right?
Of course.
And you have his cell phone number too. So
yes.
That's the problem, right?
Mm.
I'm not accusing anyone of direct corruption here necessarily, but that's simply what I guess politely would be called the political economy of this transformation that is very, very, very difficult to cut through without saying, you who have previously won in this game, your profits are going down. While, you know, 9 million of us, 8 billion of us globally might benefit, but of course there are some very, very rich, very, very well-connected losers in this game. And that's the problem.
I hear you. And I have rarely be someone so precise in naming. Giving it the name.
Pöstlingberg?
not about the specifics, but the mechanisms and actually addressing that it's a systematic challenge we have here, which unfortunately there are no easy answers for, right?
And, correct. And in a funny way, so it's honestly, it's the head of the cement company, the CEO of the steel company, the CEO of the fossil company, they are painfully aware of what's happening. In some sense, they know better than the rest of us what it actually takes to transform the steel company. Of course they do. Now, they also very much know that, there may not be a first mover advantage. Let's put it mildly, right? It's the second mouse who gets the cheese. Right. And that's, of course, part of the problem here as well.
Yeah, exactly. And in this case, that CEO, if taking a look who's going to pay for it, right, he's taking a look at the shareholders, ratepayers, taxpayers. Well, it's pretty much not going to be the shareholders that's going to be on top of that list, right?
So, I mean, yes, I think the short answer is yes. Now, the slightly longer one is, depends on who, of course, but turns out some of those shareholders are better informed than the rest of us, right? Okay, just to be clear, of course, right? There's plenty of rich guys who just get, you know, were born into it, right? Like, you know, sorry, not worth my time. There are some people who are where they are because you know, quote unquote, they deserve it, right? Like they worked hard and had a great idea and so on and so forth, which means they might have made a bunch of money based on the status quo, but they also do understand why that status quo will change. They do understand what it means to have a better idea and make more money of the new, you know, in the new world, basically. Take advantage of the transformation, right? And I think part of this then also is, in some sense, again, we're back to timing now, right? Now it's not just who, it's also who and when, right? Let me say this out loud here. So the most impressive conversation like this I've ever had was at the 7th Arab Fiscal Forum in Dubai. 12 Arab finance ministers, you know, 11 dudes and one woman, the Moroccan is the woman, at the managing director of the IMF, who, by the way, herself is an environmental economist. So, you know, she definitely gets it. And I'm the climate guy, right? Like, I'm there to give like a 20-minute TED talk on climate, basically, to these, you know, 13 people sitting around the table. And the most interesting conversation was right after, over lunch, with the Saudi finance minister, who, you know, he and the delegation, of course, there's 60 people you talk to when you talk to him, who more or less said something along the lines of, I always thought this transformation was expensive. And like I was talking about trillions of dollars, right? And, you know, it wasn't like he was sort of, you know, ready to pull out his wallet and, you know, start counting, you know, dollars or whatever. But actually pretty close. He was essentially saying, wait, I thought to get to this new world would sort of just mean the end of the world, right? Like everything collapses, right? Economy versus the climate, as opposed to basically what, you know, he told me, like what you were saying here. And, you know, this is not my calculations, right? This is, hey, you know, McKinsey and Goldman and BlackRock, they're all saying the same thing, right? That at the end of the day, of course, there's a shifting of investments from dirty to clean and so on. Mm-hmm. But the full-scale transformation costs money up front. Sure. Mm-hmm. And then you're printing money for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. And, okay, I don't want to make too much of this one meeting in, you know, March 20, whenever it was, 23, I believe, right before the Dubai climate talks, or 9 months before the Dubai climate talks. But let's put it mildly, there's been follow-ups ever since that lead me to believe that it's the sort of change in mindset, thinking, if you will, were like maybe the big change is not economy versus, but the question is, how do you make money off the transformation? So in other words, when do you switch? How do you do it? And yeah, who pays, right? And again, not if, when, who, and how, which is exactly, of course, I mean, that's not enough, right? We actually enjoy. That's where you want to be, right? You want to be in a world where, let's say, and this is real, Saudi Arabia has a net zero goal. Saudi Arabia has a net zero goal of 2060. Now, okay, that's too late. It's not as ambitious as Europe. But okay, compare Europe to the Saudis. The difference is 10 years. 10 years.
Yes.
10 years makes a big difference in climate terms. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, sorry, if the Saudis have a net zero goal, none of this is if. It's when.
And the Saudis have the resources to actually really make it happen.
They have power, resources, right? I mean, they to install the panels, but they can literally, I mean, let me put it mildly in sort of in somewhat offensive terms, I guess. But if you burn oil to air-conditioned tents, you have a real problem, right? First of all, you know, insulate your buildings, right? Yeah. Don't air-condition the indoor ski slope in Dubai that basically is a tent, right? Like there's, you know, air leaking out left and right. And by the way, why would you burn oil to make it cold enough to ski in the desert when at the end of the day you can, you know, I'm not against skiing. I love my skiing. I would never do it in the desert, but why not build a solidly insulated building, A, right? And B, why not power it with solar panels on the roof as opposed to burning oil on the ground, right? And
exactly.
That's the sort of investments that are needed. And okay, who has the money to put up the, you know, the $15,000 for the heat pump up front?
Yes. If you put that to the macro scale, then it's not maybe the 15,000, but yes, I get the,
it's in digit trillions of dollars globally. Yeah,
absolutely. But doable, right? And I think it's about like the same as how to put it, making the household understand that 15,000 might be a good investment long term.
Yep.
Or enabling finance options for them to actually do this, right? On micro scale, mm-hmm. it's the same as macro scale. And there it is, this, what you described as this level of aha and realization.
Yeah.
This might actually be something very profitable. So we should consider this, right?
Yes. And okay. So like your true macro scale, not doing something about climate change costs double digit trillions of dollars.
Yeah.
Doing something costs in terms of investment, right? Single digit trillions of dollars, right? So there is no comparison, right? Like from a global perspective, is it worth it to transform? Of course it is. We'll all benefit. Now, of course, now we're back to the problem, right? There's 8 billion of us who benefit. So it's in nobody's direct self-interest to be doing it. Not that they could, right? But man, you and I are not going to invest the money, quote unquote, rationally in order to benefit the 8 billion, right? Because yeah, the benefits are diffuse. The costs are internalized, right? That's the problem. It's social benefits, private costs. Now, of course, the flip side, right, is, okay, first of all, as a policymaker, you ought to consider the benefits to society. Let's start with that, right? Duh. And the problem, of course, of politics comes in immediately because those who pay the costs, right, are the ones with the loudest lobby. But on top of that, the real question, of course, is how to make the benefits so visceral, so obvious that none of that, right, global commons problem, mumbo jumbo, matters. And by the way, we are at the stage now back to climate tech getting cheaper, better all the time, right? Where it pays for you and I personal to invest the better insulation and the heat solar panels and the induction stove and the electric vehicle and so on, because the benefits to me personally are so large by now to compare to the costs, which are getting, you know, cheaper all the time.
Yes. And this is something that kind of resembles a little bit our thinking when we work with clients and when the question is on the electrification of vehicles and electrification of fleets. Because ultimately there has to be a clear value path for them. It's like, maybe it's not the cheapest in the first investment, but it has to be financially viable. And the better option, and then adoption is going to come. We see that either each and every day. Gernot, I have got one question that I ask every interview partner in this Nectar conversation. And that's a little game. Are you ready to play?
Sure.
Perfect. So,
do I have a choice? I guess it's my real question.
Maybe not. So it's an easy one. So imagine we put ourselves into a time capsule and we kind of transport ourselves into the year 2035. So 10 years from now. From 10 years from now, the position of 2035, looking back at the two of us right now,
mm-hmm.
what advice would you give the two of us?
Don't let the short-term political headwinds stand in the way of the quote-unquote vision of what 2035 or whatever year you choose could ought to look like, right? So, but different. So, of course, right? So, once again, right? So, turns out, yeah, like the coal investment right now, right, gets heavily subsidized by the U.S. federal government. None of this is a play for the future, right? It's a play for short-term profits. So, in other words, investing in coal right now because it gives you the short-term subsidies, misguided subsidies, right, is a fool's errand. For all the obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And investing in the right kind of technology, right? The, you know, personal level, the heat pump, the induction stove, the better insulation, the electrification writ large, of course, is the way to go. And that's it, right? Like that's the storyline where the real question ought to be, right? The question from 2035 back to 2025 is, okay, how do I invest that money? How do I justify the investment right now even though it may not pay in the next 6 months, but clearly will have paid by 2035 over and over, right? Many times over. Mm-hmm. And yeah, maybe the best example, maybe the gas furnace versus the heat pump yet again, right? The gas furnace that's 5% more efficient is around for what, 40 years, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
30 years, 20 years minimum, right?
Mm-hmm.
The heat pump, that is the only real way to get to minus 100% as opposed to minus 5%, right? Takes the wherewithal to say, yeah, I'm okay looking out for my future self over, you know, the myopic 6 months of whatever self-interest. So yeah, so in one sentence, it's don't think in quarters, don't think in months or whatever, or, you know, next week's or next month's paycheck. Think in, where do you actually want to be 5-10 years from now? Because frankly, 10 years from now is right around the corner.
Yes. Thank you very much, Gernot. Thank you for the advice. It's a very clear one and a refreshing one. And also thank you so much for this conversation. I immensely enjoyed it. I learned a ton. There were a lot of aha moments in there, and this is of an immense value. And I assume same is true for the listeners on the audience of this Nectar conversation. Gernot, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. I leave the closing word for you.
Thank you. I learned a lot too. And yeah, that's the best kind of place to be. And I can tell you, right, for climate, it's basically the same thing. Moving in the right direction means climbing the learning curve. Yes, sliding down the cost curve, but climbing the learning curve first and foremost. And yeah, that future, that cleaner, greener, meaner, leaner future can only get better, largely because you have no choice. And, you know, that's ending on a pessimistic note, if you will. But the optimistic version, of course, is that the low carbon future is not one of compromises. It's one of embracing new clean tech.
And it's not a question of if, it's just a question of when, if I may quote you. Thank you. Thank you for the conversation.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to Nectar's Conversation Journeys. Subscribe and tune in again next time.